Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very pleased today to be speaking with Dr. Maggie Messett about her book titled Newspaper, which is one of the newest additions to the Object Lesson series from Bloomsbury, just out in 2024, which is a really cool take on the newspaper. In some senses, it is a history of the thing called a newspaper, fair enough, but this book really does a lot more than this. It takes us into particular places and times, I won't give away quite where yet, and examines things like censorship, like historical records, like politics, the best and worst kinds, and really a lot more. So Maggie, thank you so much for coming onto the podcast to tell us about your book.
Thanks for having me.
Could you start us off, please, by introducing yourself and telling us a bit about why you decided to write the book Newspaper for the Object Lesson series?
Yeah, I am currently the director of the News Lab at Penn State University, where I'm also faculty. My background is really as both a journalist and an educator in pretty unique and unusual ways. I spent a good decade in South Africa running what is one of the earliest post-apartheid nonprofit newsrooms in a rural community. And my experience in the United States as a journalist has been about building newsrooms, either helping newsrooms in transition or building news organizations from scratch. I started working on newspaper during the pandemic. I would say that my sort of life as a journalist is very fieldwork based. And in the pandemic, nobody wanted to meet with me in the field. And so I needed to think about a work that allowed me to immerse myself inside of something. In this case, a lot of archives digitally to start with. And to also kind of put a book together that was the culmination of 20 years of my life.
Hmm. All right. Well, that's a very intriguing start. And I think we're probably going to get into a number of the pieces that you mentioned there. So good introduction to our discussion. Can you tell us a bit about how the book is organized and why you chose to do it in this way?
Yeah. So I would say that the book is really, I saw it as a book-length essay. And the final result for me was a segmented essay and a braided essay in one. The Object Lesson series requires you to have sort of this challenge of constraint, which means that it is much shorter than a typical book. My first book was, just for context, my first book was a little over 70,000 words. All Object Lessons books are around 28 to 30,000 words. I pushed it to 32,000, and that was a big deal. So really, because I had a desire to tell the story of 400 years of history within the context of sort of newspapers in two separate nations, the United States and South Africa, the two places I call home, it was this real challenge in constraint. And so as I dug into the stories and as I had to start making choices about what to include and what not to include, I saw the form of a segmented essay. These little bits and pieces that are almost plot points that I selected throughout history as opposed to giving you giant history lessons. So it is unusual. You cross through time from the 1600s to the present day. You weave between the United States and South Africa. And so it is a complicated structure, but it gives room for the reader in between each of these segments, that white space gives room for the reader to do some work. There's a term in comics studies called closure, that sort of the reader, when moving from one panel to the next, when reading comics, that reader is then making connections and sort of understanding what hasn't been said explicitly. And that's the beauty of sort of a structure that gives you that white space that asks the reader to start making connections and start thinking about how each of these segments tell us a larger, more complicated story.
Hmm. Okay, there's a bunch of things there that I'm going to ask you about more. But I think the first one is kind of, why compare the US and South Africa?
Yeah, I mean, for me, as I said, it's the culmination of my life in many ways. I moved to South Africa when I was, I think 22. I moved there in 2003 and pretty soon after never really thought I was coming back. I am a dual citizen, not by birth, but because I was invested in a country and a community in a way that I felt I didn't want to leave because of the work that I was doing and because of the relationships I was building. And I was in South Africa at a time within the context of newspapers, at a time that the nation needed growth of local papers. I moved there 9 years post-apartheid, and I was there for a little under a decade before sort of life called me back to the United States. And I think being back in the U.S. gave me some context of how complicated, how important, but also how deeply complicated media is inside of a democracy. And when I returned to the US in around 2011, I was sort of thrust into another complicated space. So much of my work in South Africa was about helping build the rural landscape and to help journalists post-apartheid navigate what does it mean to no longer be under censorship? What does it mean to build local media and national media in this new democracy? So every time I ran a nonprofit newsroom in the former apartheid era, homelands of Gazankulu and Lebowa, and it was really the first paper that represented the community. And I ran a school for women journalists to be able to work on that paper, but to also be able to join mom and pop newsrooms that sort of dotted the rural communities. It wasn't intended for folks to go through a program and then go to the urban communities and send money home. It was meant to invest in women journalists to be able to stay in the rural communities, to write about their community, to represent their community, and to grow local papers. There was a lot of money being poured into building out community journalism post-apartheid. And every time we published a paper, we would have these sort of small, almost town hall-like conversations that were both preparing people to see themselves in the paper, especially if there were some complicated stories coming out, but also just to have conversations about the critical role of having this paper in your community as you're growing democracy. Prior to that, they had papers that represented urban spaces 5 hours away, right? Joburg and Pretoria were 5 hours to the west, and Nelspruit was about 2.5 hours to the south, and that typically represented the media landscape that they were experiencing up until then. When I came back into the country, I worked in local media in Wisconsin for several years, and then eventually I served as the founding national director for Report for America, which is a national service program that places emerging and established journalists in local newsrooms across the country to try to support newsrooms that were getting cuts for economic reasons or needing to grow in spaces that they felt that they had been neglecting over time, and also placing journalists in roles that represented things they hadn't done well, representing potential spaces where they'd actually caused harm over time. And so these two things really, these two experiences, both spanning sort of a decade, during the pandemic, I had time to really think about the history of newspapers. We're seeing them disappear. Object Lessons is wonderful to think about a single object, but I felt like I was thinking about a single object that in my lifetime might completely disappear and yet represented 20 years of my life and work and advocacy. And so not only having these two things alongside one another and thinking about what does it say about the role of a paper when they're alongside one another, but what does it also say about these two nations that were in many ways, colonialism in both spaces started occurring at the same time. And what happens when we look at these two stories alongside one another? How does it make us look at South Africa in a different way? How does it make us look at our own nation in a new and complicated way? I think that Americans think of South Africa in a particular way and vice versa. And I had a unique vantage point to complicate the narrative, no matter who the reader is, to think about censorship and to think about the ways in which the paper, the existence of newspapers and its origins were used to support progress and to support increased freedoms and to support someone's agenda in good and bad ways. I see the paper in this structure, in this weaving of these two stories. I think it became clearer and clearer to me that papers were used for progress and to advance as much as they were used to keep people down.
All right. So I'd love to talk a bit about kind of how you've done that, given what you've so helpfully explained to us, kind of were your motivations and really vantage point for telling this story and weaving all of these snapshots together. Going back to what you were saying earlier about kind of the size of this book and the scale and scope of your ambition and your goal that you've just detailed, how did you decide what snapshots to include and in what level of detail? Maybe you could even give us a few examples.
Yeah. So I tend to write long. And so whenever I was working on a magazine piece, if I was told I had 3,000 words, my first draft might have been 8,000 words. And in the same way, my first draft of this book was about 70,000 words. And I needed to read and revise with the aim of thinking about what are those plot points that really tell this narrative. What are the plot points that seem less expected? I didn't want this to feel like a history book. And so one of the things that's important to understand about each of these segments is that they could theoretically stand alone, but they're not really meant to stand alone. They're meant to alongside or sort of with segments interspersed to complicate one another. And sometimes that means having two pieces alongside one another that maybe complicate what might be expected in one narrative but unexpected in another narrative. The production of this, like how to actually do this, made me go back to everything that I do when I'm working on any piece of journalism, which is think about where the camera is focused. So each segment, I had to decide how intimate is this going to be. So sometimes if it was a more expected story, a story that some might already think that they know, I wanted to place the camera so that we had a much more intimate vantage point. So in that case, when I think cinematically, a close-up shot means that we have much more intimate, much more granular detail. We feel like we're in the moment with someone. If I'm using a long shot, then I might be sort of giving you less granular, intimate detail and trying to sort of give you some scope about something happening in history. I would use those as transitions because really I was focused on making sure that you felt as the reader like you are alongside these characters that you may have never heard of or may have heard of, but you're alongside them as they're creating papers, as they're navigating pushback against something that they're producing, or as they're sort of forging their own sort of path or way. And so I see this really as a collection of characters and movements and moments in time that help you understand these 400 years in a much more sort of complicated way. It's also really a narrative of building democracy and sort of the ebbs and flows and the steps back and the steps forward. And so I had to pick and choose characters that would help me tell that complicated narrative. And I had to get rid of a lot of them, folks that I, you know, fell on the editing room floor. But really, what we're left with is it moves faster. It leaps through time. But even though there are folks you don't learn about, you still understand sort of the narrative arc of these two countries over the 400 years.
I can imagine just how much must have been left on the cutting room floor. The idea that it was twice as long when you first wrote it does not surprise me at all, especially given how much work must have kind of gone into this in terms of just finding out, especially not wanting to fall into the sort of telling the stories we might be more familiar with already. You've spoken a bit about the use of digital archives, but can you tell us more about how you researched all of this?
Yeah, I had to start with digital archives for a couple reasons. One, I proposed this during the pandemic, and so my initial research was through digital archives. And many of those digital archives grew during the pandemic because librarians and libraries had the time and had the ability to focus on digitization. There was a real rise of digitization in both South Africa and the United States in many libraries. And so I really started digitally, and that benefit me in being able to really just consider these early stages as a digital form of immersion journalism. I needed to think about what papers were doing, how papers changed over time in terms of structure and what its role was in the community. We think so much about how papers have started to disappear since the advent of the internet. And I had such a lovely time diving into local community papers in the 1800s and thinking about the ways in which social media today can be seen inside those papers. So much so that my partner was, you know, in the pandemic, as we would probably everybody across the globe, was binging streaming shows and reading books. I was deep diving into these narratives inside papers and popping out to say, oh my gosh, you wouldn't believe it. This person in this town, let me tell you the story that I'm pulling out. And I was pulling those out of these sections that I don't think most people realize are in papers. They kind of remind me of the very earliest days of Facebook when people would say, you know, I'm headed to the store or I'm headed to dinner. These very sort of mundane single sentence statements about our lives, that in the 1800s, there were these community sections where it would say, so-and-so's cousin came to town for the week and is returning, but will be back in 3 months. Or, you know, so-and-so went on vacation and will be home this week, right? So we knew people's movement. We knew when someone was sick and not coming out of the house. We understood when someone was coming to town to think about, bringing their business to town. We heard about people's livestock dying. We heard about somebody changing something in their home. It was like these really tiny, mundane announcements, but it allowed you to see the rhythms of someone's life. It allowed you to go in and read the narratives of a single family over a couple years and understand what was happening, understand how illnesses were impacting families, understand what was happening in the justice system, understand what was happening economically. And you really could see the growth of communities and what communities were prioritizing just through these tiny little community announcements that was not considered journalism at the time. You could also see just the evolution of journalism. Journalism, as much as we want to talk about being unbiased, and my students talk all the time, I find it fascinating. I teach a class with 300 students every fall that are mostly freshmen or transfer students. And they seem so, they have such a desire to go into journalism to address the bias that they feel and that they see. So much of it influenced on the broadcast news that they don't watch, but I think that their parents and grandparents watch, and they see it so divided. And they come in and say, I want to bring journalism back to what it was. I want to enter into journalism because I want to help the space go back to being neutral. Well, I hate to break it to you, journalism did not start neutrally. Journalism was brought, was born out of making sure that someone's voice could be heard, and often for advocacy purposes. In the U.S., our colonial papers, really the bulk of them were devices to and funded by political groups or advocacy groups. They represented singular voices or community voices that were after something. And they were meant to serve a particular community in the same way that we look at community papers today, but they were meant to represent what they wanted and needed. And that means that we had lots of tiny papers all over the place, representing different vantage points, intentionally representing different vantage points. And they saw themselves as a place for editorializing. It was not a place for what we think of as journalism today, really, until the 1900s. It transitioned in the 1800s to something where there were editorial sections, but not till the late 1800s, turning into the early 1900s, did we have this division between editorial and reporting, our who, what, when, where, why, and how. The origins of papers did not focus on being unbiased. They focused on being biased. They shouted to the high heavens that women need to vote or that slavery is a bad thing. And we need to know these things. We need to know who came before us and what the purpose of these papers were from day one and what they evolved into, in order to understand how we got to the moment that we're in when it comes to not trusting media. Yes, I'm talking about newspapers, but really this is understanding media generally and the role that has played over time. And that is pretty much the same in South Africa and in the United States. It's just ebbs and flows slightly differently. But we're talking about two nations that were really, and I'll say nations sort of loosely, we're talking about two bodies of land that were colonized around the same time, and that newspapers were used to help in that colonization. And they were also used to help in movement west in the United States and movement east in South Africa. And as we settled into new spaces, it was always met with the start of a paper. The paper was meant to be able to disseminate information, but it was also meant to establish priorities, to help people understand what was important to that community, and to make sure that the dominant voice could be heard.
Those are, I think, some really helpful continuities that, in many ways, thinking through kind of that period of history, it's not hugely surprising to hear you say it, but isn't necessarily what we think, especially sitting in today's media environment. And yes, I agree. I've also heard from students this idea of kind of going back to, going, well, hang on a second, if we do go back there, then we have to understand the motivations for people starting newspapers are maybe not what we idealistically might assume. Are all of these sorts of reasons, do you think, about kind of community news, about putting us forward particular agendas, etc., is this not just why newspapers start, but also why they proliferate? Or did you kind of find different reasons or factors that help explain why in certain times and moments we might see kind of an explosion of newspapers in particular moments?
Yeah, I think there's two reasons that I saw sort of consistently in both countries where you saw large numbers of papers rise really quickly. One of them, as I said, was about movement. So in the US, what I didn't know before doing this was that every time we wanted to establish a new territory or a new state, this was very much grounded in statehood, we needed a paper. And it was really required for there to be a paper. So there became this major rush of not just brand new newspapermen, but newspapermen who had the paper of the state or the paper of a particular city. They were sort of preemptively looking westward and saying, there's a new state about to be formed and we are going to nab that paper. And really that meant two things. And this is what's so interesting, because people don't think of papers as being so inextricably linked with government. But the paper of the new state was also the same people that got the printer's contract from the state government. So as we established new states, we had people wanting, moving often, you know, often we have one example of as the state of Minnesota was starting to form, we had newspapermen from Ohio and Wisconsin and elsewhere competing against one another as to who was going to get named the state paper. And so much so that the newspapermen in Cincinnati printed the paper for Minnesota in Ohio, saying that they were the first paper to be printed in Minnesota as a way to sort of preemptively say, we're going to be the people chosen. Well, they weren't, right? We had a small paper or a small newspaperman move from Wisconsin to Minnesota who ended up getting that deal. But it was much more than just getting a paper. There was intense status, really important status that was bestowed upon the company or typically the single newspaperman or pair of newspapermen who got that state contract. That meant that they also got to print every single piece of legislation. They printed what was considered the government gazette, which was information coming out of the government. It meant that they became very wealthy and that they also had major power and real status in the community. And so you saw this sort of newspaper rush of sorts, right? We think of people in the United States moving westward for the gold rush. This was this sort of newspaper rush that was happening. And this was happening at the state level, and it was happening in towns. So people, as folks were moving westward, newspapermen were finding ways to bring their, you know, really bulky printing presses and how to get them westward. the same thing was happening in South Africa, except in South Africa, so many of the early papers were also coming out of missions. And so there was this also secondary complicated nature of them coming out of missionaries. And the mission papers in South Africa also were complicated for South Africa when they were simultaneously trying to serve as a source of information. But the mission system in South Africa really educated Black South Africans at the time in an amazingly robust and forward-looking way. And so some of the most important South Africans early and later in history were educated on these missions, ran papers on these missions, helped publish books on these missions. These were intellectual spaces. They were still complicated when it came to race, but they really helped educate and move sort of language and printing forward in the country and to really help build a Black intellectual class much earlier than people realize. The second sort of space that I saw a huge rise was really in movements, right? Every time a paper or every time there was a new movement, there were these new clusters of papers. And those movements can be really obvious, right? We have sort of the anti-apartheid movement, where you had a lot of what at that time they referred to as sort of the alternative papers. Those alternative papers were critical to providing information to sort of smaller, more localized spaces, but also to support almost in an underground way. They weren't considered underground papers, but they did function like that in a lot of ways. In the same way that we see in the anti-slavery movement, we saw lots of papers rise up in anti-slavery. You saw the same thing in the 60s and the 70s in the US. They're some of my favorite papers. And part of that is because after the printing press, we ended up having sort of multiple small at-home printing presses that then eventually led to the Xerox machine, mimeographs in the middle, but also all these small iterations gave people, just like the internet does, the ability to print, the ability to publish quite easily. And so you started seeing these underground anti-war movements and all these tiny papers popping up. You saw, as you know, in the 60s and 70s, you saw a lot of LGBT papers pop up that were being printed late at night on presses that were otherwise printing mainstream news. You saw zines pop up, which are really a part of the newspaper lineage, because a lot of things started at home or started on Xerox machines, and a small number of them, or mimeographs, and a small number of them were printed until they just either disappeared or sometimes became mainstream. And so we really see this in both movement and development in these countries, but we also see it in these movements. And when there was a movement like we are seeing across the United States right now on college campuses, where there are movements, there are papers, even if those papers are handwritten. One of the spaces that I think I was most surprised about was the rise of papers during the civil wars. And I say civil wars with lowercase letters. The wars that took place in South Africa in the 1700s and the 1800s, and the wars that were taking place in the United States, amazing things happened. In fact, I was shocked to find out that there were warnings that because most papers in the United States were printed in the North, that before the Civil War started, there were warnings that they needed to make sure that they could still print papers in the South, and that they needed not only the printing presses, but the supplies, because those papers were critical ways of communicating to people. And so we saw people printing on everything from when they ran out of paper, which was pretty quickly. We saw people printing on wallpaper. We saw people printing on these sort of index cards, really like postcards. They would print on whatever they could. And you saw them be short-lived. You saw them sort of pop up and disappear based off of where battles might be taking place. But they were a critical component to communication during wars, and not the way people might think in terms of internal communication. It was about communicating to people who were civilians.
I admit I was also surprised about the wallpaper as a printing material. And I think it does speak so much to kind of everything you're talking about in terms of how much drive there clearly is for people to get their ideas out there in all sorts of circumstances. So thank you very much for telling us a bit more about kind of what that looks like more realistically than idealistic ideas. I wonder if I can ask you kind of both about a structural choice you've made, but also about the kind of content within it, kind of combining two of the strands I've been asking you about so far. We haven't really talked about kind of how you've organized the snapshots in terms of chronology. Perhaps the kind of assumption listeners have made is the logical one, that you're telling a history here, and so we're moving sort of from the past to the present, which is mostly what you're doing. But could you speak a bit about how you're using chronology in the book, especially towards the end?
Yeah, it's complicated. It is chronological. There are 120 segments in the book. And I would say while it's chronological, it's not always, you know, it's chronological, but you have two narratives taking place, which means that sometimes in the US we're speeding up and sometimes in South Africa we're slowing down. And so because it's a braided narrative, we are not necessarily in the same time in both countries side by side. Why is that? Sometimes that has to do with a real intense explosion of papers and an important time to sort of slow down. Sometimes that's because I intentionally want you to see two things side by side because of their similarity or how complicated it is when you actually see them next to one another. And then in the end, it really is, in some ways, it happened accidentally, and in some ways, it happened intentionally. I want you to see the rise and fall of papers. I should say the rise, fall, and then rise again of papers in South Africa, from the end of apartheid to post-apartheid, where my life was there. But I also wanted you to see the ebb that we're in the United States in particular. And ultimately, it's also really about press freedom and looking at what it means in both countries to be inside periods where we have journalists at risk and journalists at risk of being arrested, of being jailed. And it really did in some ways accidentally happen in my sort of culling of pieces. But you see a slowdown in the South African narrative during apartheid because there were so, or I should say during the period of the last decade of apartheid, because there was so much happening that was really the only way that South Africans could know what was happening in areas that they didn't live. And when I say that, I mean those are tight areas. Those are small areas. The only way people knew what was happening was because of the news. And in many ways, they didn't fully know what was happening everywhere because of the censorship. And the peaks, the little tiny cracks in the window that they could see were because of the alternative newspapers, because they would try to find ways, while not getting shut down, although many of them did, they would try to find ways to really say what was happening. What's interesting about that time period, but the same thing happens in the late 1800s, early 1900s, is you start to see the South African narrative in the United States, and you start to see some U.S. narrative in South Africa. So even though we're moving chronologically, there are characters from South Africa that appear in the U.S. narrative, and in a smaller way, vice versa. And so we really are, from the vantage point of thinking about democracy, from thinking about sort of racism in our bones as a nation, thinking about the ways in which papers were being used at the time, they become so entangled with one another that they really, at the end, for me, are telling one story.
How fascinating to kind of understand in some ways how you got to that. I was very curious reading that section of the book, kind of, did you plan to do this all along, or how did you end up deciding on this ending? So it's really interesting to hear about kind of how it in some ways evolved into itself, if that makes sense. I wonder if I can ask you, in some ways, we've started from the beginning of the history of why people are creating newspapers all the way up to very much the present. Of the many different sections and segments within the book, are there one or two stories that you found particularly interesting that maybe you'd like to share with us, or maybe surprising?
Gosh, you know, this was really hard for me because in some ways I felt like I spent so much time with each of these segments, or each of these characters and movements in the segments. And in some ways, I feel like I researched enough that I could have written an entire chapter and instead wrote three paragraphs, or three pages. And some of them I fell in love with that are really unexpected, that don't necessarily move the narratives that I've talked about, the complicated narratives. Many of them do. But then there were some that I just kind of loved. One, for example, and Miranda, I should actually ask you, do you want me to read a segment or do you just want me to talk about it?
Whichever you prefer. It's your book.
I'm actually going to read one segment to you that is really just endearing and powerful in terms of just sort of remembering the reasons and motivation behind someone starting a paper. And to me, this is not necessarily just a U.S. story, although none of them are just U.S. or just South Africa. Let me just try and find this for you. So, as I said, there's 120 segments. This is segment 56, and this was one that I just sort of happened upon. And in my cuts, as I was sort of trying to figure out what needed to make it, I should say this is one that didn't need to make it, but I loved so much that had to stay in. And I think it really symbolizes when someone has the desire to feel like they have access to something or to feel represented, that their motivation is so strong, even if it takes years, they will make this happen for themselves as far as papers go. So I'm just going to read this. It's on the longer end of my segments, but that really just means it's only two pages. Bundles of the weekly news were loaded into a taxi. Wrapped in mattress ticking, 200 copies, all they had printed, were transported to the South Postal Annex in Boston. It was March 17, 1927. And the first issue of the paper was on its way to readers across Massachusetts. Its founder, Francis B. Ariardi, had long dreamt of printing his own paper. Francis was a piano tuner, pianist, cellist, and a graduate of the New England Conservatory of Music. But Francis loved the news. When Francis was 12, living in New York, he and a friend were playing in a construction site where they picked up poles and sticks and started to smash them together, likely an imaginary sword fight. But one of those sticks was dynamite. The explosion destroyed one of his eyes, and the other quickly deteriorated. He was left blind. At Perkins School for the Blind, Francis learned Braille, a tool first used for music notation, long before it was used for reading instruction. Francis graduated in 1908, but he stayed with Perkins to continue his musical studies before moving on to the conservatory. This is when he met Laura Sterling, a kindergarten teacher at Perkins. Laura had immigrated to the U.S. as an adult on her own. The two married in 1916 during the height of World War I. Laura used to read the newspaper to Francis every evening, something he yearned to do for himself. Francis was fiercely independent. He never used a cane or a guide dog, and he used public transportation to get to work. He would carry a briefcase with his initials, FBI, and would eventually joke that this kept people away. His job with the Department of Education's Division of the Blind had him reading brailled documents throughout the day, and the Perkins Brailler and Howe Press had been publishing books for the blind for 80 years. But there were no printed news sources available to the blind, and most were reliant on family and friends to read them the news. Francis set out to print a newspaper in Braille in 1918, but it would take nearly a decade until the first issue came off the press. In a building used by Howe Press in South Boston, Weekly News, the first Braille newspaper in the Western Hemisphere, was printed and collated by volunteers working evenings. Many were graduates of Perkins. So this is really simple, and it gives you kind of an example of how we really zoom in on a single person's life, and that I don't tell you this giant sort of narrative or history book on Francis and the paper. I had to really kind of pick a moment in time and help you learn about Francis and learn about the paper. I had never heard of this paper before. It ended up being really important, and it really was run entirely by people who were blind and mostly volunteers in its duration.
Wow, what a great one to pick. Thank you so much for selecting it, reading it to us, and telling us a bit about that one. I think it does really exemplify a lot of what's in the book in a sense. Given that then, and what we've discussed so far, what do you hope readers take away from this book?
You know, ultimately, I should take a step back. I think that when my first book came out, which is solely set in South Africa, I often found myself talking about just how complicated my understanding of the United States became in a more nuanced way when I returned. And I think that I find that this book, sure, we're learning about newspapers. Sure, I think it's a wonderful time for us to think about what newspapers have done well, what newspapers have done and influenced in terrible ways, in order for us to think about how we maintain community media and how we want to see media in the future. But I think that the same elements that I was talking about in my first book, sort of understanding what it means to be in a nation, whether it be South Africa or the United States, that has a real intense systemic racism at its core, and how that presents itself through media, and how that presents itself through the people and the movements behind media, and how we use media to pull ourselves away from that history, it's really complicated. And I think that I see this as something that has no answers, but I see this as something that requires us to think in a more nuanced, complicated way, and that it is asking the reader to do what I ask my students to do, which is to think about who came before us. What was that reporting like? What was the motivation behind that reporting? And how has that impacted the community over time? Because if you're a reporter or even a community member, but if you're a reporter stepping into a newsroom today and you only think about what's happening in this moment, you are not serving the community. You need to understand how that community has experienced media up until now, good and bad. You need to understand who in that community has not felt heard, who in that community has felt poorly represented by the media, in order to really understand why we are the way we are right now, deeply divided in both nations. How did we get here? And in many ways, I think we can look at this. As I said, it does not have the answers, but I think it allows you, or at least gets you started in understanding how we are in two deeply divided nations at the same time.
Hmm. Having read the book, I think those are definitely questions that readers are likely to think about coming to the end of them. So thank you for raising them for discussion here as well. Is there anything now that it's done that you might be working on now or next?
Yeah, I'm actually working on something that I've been working on for the last decade. And over the next couple months, I look forward to finishing it and handing it off. I started, one of the reasons I came back from South Africa when I did is because my mother's youngest sister went missing. And I started working on sort of her story, her case in real time from afar when I was in South Africa. And eventually I came back not intending to stay. I came back intending to kind of work on this case. And I spent a couple years going back, living sort of 3 months in the US, 3 months in South Africa, back and forth, back and forth. And not only is that not sustainable, but her story and missing persons in the United States really became my focus. And I spent a couple years doing intense field work and at a certain point working with a private investigator, but then kind of continuing that work on my own. And the result is a really deeply personal sort of hybrid of investigative journalism and memoir, the story of my aunt and the life that led up to her missing persons case, but also the story of resolving that case. It's also really about sort of the missing persons crisis in America and understanding how there really is no system supporting families and supporting the missing.
Wow, very intense and sounds quite important project. So thank you for giving us that preview and best of luck, as you said, finishing it off and passing it along to the next stage. And while you do that, of course, listeners can read the book we've been discussing titled Newspaper, part of Bloomsbury's Object Lessons series that has already come out earlier this year in 2024. Maggie, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.